So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod.
Episode 37. Right, we're back.
We're back for another episode. It's a lovely, warm, sunny day.
We are a little bit late. That is my fault.
You've got a good excuse, though, haven't you? Come on, mate. It's not every day you get married.
Yeah, I did go and get married, and then I went away for a few days after that, so...
Yeah, we'll forgive you.
Sorry, but we are now
what
back.
What a damn fine wedding it was.
It was great fun. And actually, to be fair, people spotted buzzards flying overhead, and that's relevant to this episode.
Yes.
But because of the wedding and whatnot, and busy at work, I haven't really been out... doing any photography. I don't know, have you got any catch up other than
apart from the fact I was best man at your wedding? No. I haven't really. I've been out, done a bit of birding, but I will say I've probably done more bird photography in my garden recently, because
it is looking like a nature reserve at the moment.
I've got so many birds coming in. I've had greenfinches, goldfinches, I've had lovely to see sparrows coming in,
a lot of starlings,
I've had blue tits, great tits, robins. I've got a big crow called Colin. Obviously, we called him Colin.
He didn't tell you.
He didn't come in to say, "Hey, I'm Colin. Do you mind if I have a little feed in your garden?"
Should have done, really.
So Colin's been in now and again, and magpies. I had swifts going overhead the other day, which was just...
Obviously, you can see all these birds on your Instagram.
Fantastic to see the swifts swooping around over the house, feeding on the wing. Apart from that, say, your wedding's pretty much taken up all of our time recently. Yeah. So, it was great.
And the only bad thing was I definitely picked up a lurgy from the wedding, and so apologies for being a bit croaky. And really, the apology has to go to you, because you're going to have to edit out all the coughs.
I'm going to be editing a lot of coughing.
I'll do my best not to.
You want to kick off?
We'll kick off. So this week's going to be a slightly different episode, because we're covering a whole group of animals rather than a single species. It was one that's slightly tricky to do our normal positive spin on things, but stick around for the end. There are some positives.
Yeah, maybe a sensitive area as well.
Yeah, it's a slightly... sensitive area, I think, is a diplomatic way of putting it. But we're going to be talking about the persecution of birds of prey, specifically in the UK, and just chatting about some of the challenges that they face that are sort of perhaps a little bit more unique to them as a group rather than so universal. Why those issues exist, and obviously we will then go on to talk about the work that's being done to try and help and combat these problems. But before we do that, I went down a bit of a rabbit hole at the beginning of my research for this episode on actually trying to define a bird of prey, because I was going to call it the persecution of raptors, and then I was like, I should probably look up the definition of that, and then didn't realize how hard it is to actually define bird of prey.
And have you managed to do that?
Not really, but I'll tell you why it's difficult. So when you think about it, a lot of birds eat other animals. You've got your normal like passerine songbirds eating insects. You've obviously got things like kingfishers, herons and egrets eating a lot of fish. Typically, birds of prey are described as hypercarnivores, which are animals that consume like more than 70% of their diet is meat, whether it's hunted or scavenged.
Yeah.
It makes up... They're not also eating a load of nuts and seeds like our songbirds would be.
Yeah, although some of them will have invertebrates and what have you, but
And typically, ornithologists will exclude many, it's a hard word to say, piscivorous predators, which are those that mainly eat fish. But then you've got things like ospreys, which eat mainly fish.
Well, and white-tailed eagles, of course,
You also have, they typically like exclude insectivorous birds. But then you've got things like the honey buzzard that specialises in eating insects
dragonflies. And I've got a fantastic picture of a kestrel with a massive beetle in its talons.
So again, tricky. It's not a hard rule.
Yeah.
There's also, owls are normally sort of grouped in. It's normally birds of prey and owls.
Yeah.
They are separate but live very similar lifestyles. So then normally the definition will be something sort of morphological rather than behavioural.
Yeah, and it is quite tricky, because you do have things like the corvids, which are carnivorous as well, aren't they? So,
yeah, and then when you look at morphology, you'll sort of look at defining characteristics like long, sharp, downward curving talons, hooked beaks and incredible eyesight. But then also you've got things like parrots that have very hooked beaks for eating nuts. So again, it's really hard. The definition I always went off, like historically, and I don't know where I read it, because when doing this research, I didn't see it anywhere, was that birds of prey are birds that hunt using their feet rather than their beaks.
Yeah.
So you've got kingfishers take a fish in their beak, osprey go and snatch them out of the water with their feet.
Yeah.
Again, I find it insane that hobbies are little falcons that catch dragonflies with their feet.
Do their feet. I've seen some fantastic film
and
with
so
that.
That's the definition I've always gone by. But I didn't actually... I thought when I typed it in, that would pop up, and I didn't. The only thing that does come up is that raptor comes from the Latin word rapio, or rapio, which means to seize or take by force, which, again, they've got very strong feet for seizing prey. So there isn't really a hard definition. I like the one that they hunt with their feet. Again, owls do the same.
Yeah.
So that's typically what I go for. But to you know, give it a bit of context, when we say birds of prey, what we're talking about really are eagles, falcons, hawks.
Actually, there are 15 species of raptor in Britain. Do you know them?
Oh, okay.
There you go. There's a little quiz question for you. I'm throwing that right in, and I've caught you right on the hop, haven't I?
So,
there are 15.
You want me to try and name all of them?
I do.
And so, I think normally it's like 21, but that must be including the owls.
Breed in Britain. So there's 15 raptors that breed, not owls. These are just raptors.
So, kestrel.
Yep.
Common buzzard.
Yep.
Honey buzzard.
Yep.
Hen harrier.
Yep.
Marsh harrier.
Yep.
Montague's harrier. Yep. Osprey,
yep.
Golden eagle,
yep.
White-tailed eagle,
yep.
Peregrine falcon,
yep.
Hobby,
yep.
Merlin.
Yep.
I'm missing a falcon somewhere.
It's a big one.
I was doing really well. Did I ever say buzzard?
Yep.
I've had a red kite.
Yep.
What's
the one that eludes me?
One that eludes you?
Yeah, that I haven't managed to get a picture of.
Is it one really obvious that
it's very obvious.
I thought I was doing quite well.
I actually named a business after it, if you remember.
Oh, goshawk. Yeah. Oh, sparrowhawk as well.
Sparrowhawk, yeah. There you go, that's it.
Okay, I did all right, apart from I forgot the hawks.
I can't believe you forgot goshawk.
Oh, you've got to give me credit for Montague's Harrow.
That's the one I thought you wouldn't get. So
only because I did some research and it popped up.
Well done.
Anyway, random quiz out. I'm quite proud of that, to be fair. Yeah, so generally when we say birds of prey, we're not talking about owls, although they face a lot of the same problems. We're looking at what essentially I've just named, eagles, falcons. Yeah. Also sometimes includes things like vultures and stuff like that, not that we have those here in the UK. Last thing I'll sort of say on the taxonomy, because I could have gone on and spoke about this for ages, is that these common names that we've just sort of given them don't really reflect the evolutionary relationships between the different groups. So just for a little bit of nerding out about taxonomy, owls belong to their own order called, I'm going to butcher this, Strigiforms, which then actually splits into two families, which I found quite funny. It's barn owls and then all other owls. I should have researched into why barn owls get their own group, but
well, just because
I didn't.
Very cool.
Then birds of prey, that umbrella title that we're using, is a bit more complex, and it's a mix of three orders. The Carthertiforms, which are your New World vultures.
Yeah.
We don't have those in the UK. Falconiforms, which are falcons, and Accipitriforms, which is then split into three families, which are sectary birds, ospreys, and all other birds of prey, eagles, kites, harriers, and hawks. So it's quite a complicated mix of all sorts of bird groups that we've then just lumped under this term, bird of prey. But for my purposes, I will forever just refer to them as birds that hunt with their feet, because it's far simpler.
I like that.
I went down the whole route of finding scientific papers delving into this taxonomy, and do you know what? If it hunts with its foot, it's a bird of prey.
It's kind of easy to remember as well, isn't it?
So. Although you do get some people who put shrikes as an honorary bird of prey, and they're the
butcher bird.
Yeah, the
they?
One that stick like lizards through thorny trees.
Yeah, no, they are quite brutal.
Yeah,
I think they are called the butcher bird, aren't they?
Because they literally catch, say, like lizards and other vertebrates, and then spear them on a thorny bush, and then
don't mess with them.
No,
you don't mess
anyway,
with a shrike.
So today we're talking about the persecution of birds of prey, and so in the UK that refers to the 15 species I've just very excellently listed.
Very excellently, I'm very impressed.
Very upset that I forgot the goshawk. Just before we dive into the problems, it's important to note that a lot of these species, I mean, obviously we're not going in species by species, so they do vary. You know, some are migrants, some are here year-round. They have different habitats and different prey preferences, and they all face a lot of the issues that we talk about in pretty much every single episode.
Habitat, so, land use change, all of that stuff.
Fragmentation of their habitat, loss of food, pollution, all sorts of things. We're not really going to go into that because, again, each species that has slightly different habitat will face slightly different habitat issues. This is very much the direct targeting of birds of prey or persecution of them through shooting, poisoning, trapping. And that's sort of the slightly heavier topic that we're talking about. But the reason why I think it's important is it's an easy thing to maybe not necessarily be aware of. But also it shows a challenge that we don't normally address, whereas we always talk about the habitat problems and things like that. This is slightly different.
And actually, as we'll find out as we go through this, it's a difficult one to address.
Yeah,
it's a difficult one to monitor as well. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on. So
just as a really quick note, so obviously as a predator, which they all are, they're really important indicator species.
Yeah.
And you know, if you've got a thriving population of apex predators, then there must be plenty of food about. And just to lead us into this topic, I didn't realise that during the 1950s and 60s, the dramatic decline of peregrine falcons was actually one of the main indicators for the impact of pesticides, which we then banned, like the DDT.
Yeah, DDT was a big one, wasn't it?
The organochlorine pesticides.
Yeah.
And one of the things that made people realise the prevalence of the problem was the loss of our bird of prey, namely peregrine falcons.
Yeah, and that's funny because at the time they were doing a study in the loss of grouse and game birds. And actually, as a result of that investigation, which was done, say, back in the 50s, they discovered actually it wasn't the grouse and game bird population that was suffering, it was actually the bird of prey population that was suffering. And that made them look into the reasons why. And of course, these pesticides, DDT was very aggressive.
Yeah, and it caused a lot of problems. And obviously, the
not
issue,
just for birds of prey, but for wildlife in general, and polluting the land as well.
It's important to note that a lot of them were banned in 1996 or something like that, and yet they are still in our waterways, soil,
and really
marine
aggressive
environments. Mm. You can still find them today. And obviously, being at the top of the food chain, it accumulates in them because they'll go and eat however many animals, all of whom will have a pesticide in them, and then they get a higher concentration, which is why it hits them so hard.
Unfortunately, that got banned.
Yes. So I have actually got essentially a definition of what bird of prey persecution is, if you want me to rattle
please.
That.
Can you just carry on? You're on a roll, mate.
I'm on a roll. So we've just had a coffee. Clearly, it's hit me.
I'm just going to sit here quietly. You carry on.
We've got so much research.
I'm loving it.
So
it doesn't matter where the info comes from, whether it comes from you or me.
I'll
just sit here and go, yeah, really? Wow. No.
So simply put, basically, it is a wildlife crime against birds of prey, their chicks and or their nest. It is one of the UK wildlife crime priorities, supposedly. And the term includes poisoning, shooting, trapping, habitat destruction and nest destruction or disturbance. However, crucially, it doesn't include any activities that are sort of done to dissuade nesting. So if birds are beginning to nest and people do something to try and stop them before they've made the nest, that does not fall under a wildlife crime. Once the nest is formed, any destruction would be. And I thought that was quite an interesting distinction.
Yeah, and it was. I think they were protected by law in this country since, I think it was the introduction of the Wildlife and Countryside Act 1981.
Yeah.
Where they finally became protected and it became illegal to obviously disturb their nests, take their eggs and persecute them.
Yeah. We've just made a slight, joke about the fact that I haven't shut up yet. And I have a whole history and timeline of bird of prey persecution in the UK do you want to chime in before I start?
I'd love you to do that. I was just going to do a little bit of...
do something
a bit
cultural.
Of our relationship with raptors goes back a very, very long time. Obviously, started with falconry. And there is actually cave art that provides evidence of that relationship. I mean, it goes back to 8,000 BC.
I think I always associate it with... because it was big in Mongolia, wasn't it? People like Genghis Khan.
I think it still is, actually.
I think that's only because I read a book about him, but they were big with their falconry.
I think falconry in this country was traditionally sort of considered a marker of high social status. So, wealth of royalty and, people loved their birds so much, they actually, were even buried with their birds, in the same place because they loved their birds. And I think hold on to that thought. This is the wealthy aristocracy and landowners that loved their birds. Hold that thought. We'll come back to that later.
I mean, even, obviously, you and I have done falconry experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably now the only way that, the general public can have contact with falcons and stuff is to go to those event days and those falconry places. And of course, the wealthy aristocracy and, you know, they don't do falconry anymore.
No, I mean, it was a huge thing. I did my work experience as a teenager at a bird of prey centre and gave talks to the public with an eagle owl on my arm and things like that. So
there's other history here about it was when the Normans arrived and land was privatised that falconry was then really restricted to the upper classes. You know, we look at Henry VIII. Henry VIII was a huge advocate. He loved his birds and hunting. Yeah, absolutely. In Tudor times, particularly. And throughout history, falconry was used mainly for hunting, but also for, you know, for leisure by the aristocracy. And actually, I found some really fascinating things. I could talk a lot about it as well. That there were indicators of social status was indicated by what bird of prey you could actually keep.
Right.
And in fact, the lower classes weren't allowed to keep birds that the upper classes were keeping. So there's a list here. And it says it was published in a 15th century book about the different species of raptor was assigned to different ranks in society. And I found this really interesting. So if you were an emperor, obviously we're talking not just UK, we're talking Europe, you kept an eagle or a vulture, a king, a gerfalcon, a prince, a peregrine falcon, a duke, also a peregrine, a knight, you could have a saker, a squire could have a lanner, a lady had a merlin, a young man could have a hobby, a yeoman, a goshawk, a priest, a sparrowhawk, a knave and a servant could keep a kestrel. So there was
this
social standing depending on what, you know, what level of bird
that's
of prey
really
that you
strange
had.
Way of like
yeah. And I also found some really fantastic, this is just me, a bit of trivia now, that falconry, which has been around in the UK for nearly sort of 2,000 years, there are words and phrases that falconers use for the birds that crept into everyday language, which I also found really interesting. One of the ones I found really interesting was the word muse, which we now associate with cottages or street names, like a muse.
I associate it with the band.
But a real muse is a home to hawks and falcons, and the Royal Mews in London was set up to house the king's birds. And the name came from the French word mure, which means to molt. So falcons were kept in mews when they were molting because they couldn't fly.
Oh, okay.
And so there are Royal Mews in London, and many stately homes still have mews associated with them, but that was all came from
falconry,
keeping birds. There's another one which I thought was also good, a good one. Cadge, the word cadge. A wooden frame that falcons were traditionally carried out onto the hunting field on was called a cadge. And the person that carried them was known as a cadger. And at the end of the day, the cadger would go into the local tavern and recount the stories of how well or how badly the birds flew. And he expected to be paid for that. And the word cadge came out of that. It now means to scrounge or to beg, something.
I've not come across that. No.
Okay, so that one has gone right over your head then. There was the other one, of course, is mantle, to cover or shield the food by dropping their wings. A bird's mantle, the cover on a fireplace, is now called a mantelpiece. A hoodwink, when you hoodwink someone, comes from the cover that birds' eyes, they use to cover the bird's eyes, and still do, to keep it calm and relaxed and hoodwink it into, you know, behaving differently. Now means to fool somebody into doing something, to hoodwink. And then the last one is fed up. A hawk is termed fed up when it has a full crop, and therefore it's not interested in doing anything. It's not interested in food or flying. And if you're fed up, you sit around doing nothing, or you're bored.
I like that one. I didn't know that. Yeah. And I use that as quite a...
Yeah. So all of these little words, which I found quite interesting, but it sort of all points to the fact that we have this wonderful relationship with falcons and birds of prey and raptors going back through the centuries. And of course, it all sort of went to pot. Not literally. It all declined rapidly on two fronts, actually, when we started sheep farming And when we started, when we invented gunpowder and guns came into being, and then they realised actually we didn't need to use falcons to go game hunting. We could just shoot them. Yeah. And it was much quicker. And we didn't have to, you know, train the birds, feed them. We could just get a gun and shoot the game birds. And then, of course, sheep farming came into being. And then we realised, or it wrongly perceived, that all birds of prey would be a threat to lambs and livestock. And we'll go on to that a bit later on as well. So anyway, that was a little bit of a history of our association with raptors.
Which is actually, that's nicely done, because now, you know, you've done the history of when we were, you know, working with them.
Yeah.
And now I can give you the history of when it all went wrong.
Yeah, which was sort so of started you, about 200 years ago.
You're going to have to, you know, bear with us now, because this is the slightly less cheery part of the podcast. But we will end on something positive.
This is the hard bit, actually.
But so stick around for the cheery finishing note. So I won't go through it in too much detail, because otherwise we will be here all
day. Yeah, it's a lot of info.
So essentially, 1800s, birds of prey sort of destruction or decline started to increase quite a lot as game shooting became a bit more widespread. Yeah. It became a more common pastime. Also around this time, you had a real boom in the strange hobbies of egg and skin collecting.
Egg collecting was a huge and thing. So it was Victorian times in particular.
They loved it. And so you've got people going out robbing, but not just birds of prey, but birds in general, but different birds, a bit like the status there are, they're going to be rarer eggs.
Yeah.
And this massively hit birds of prey.
It was a very lucrative thing.
Yeah. I mean, it still happens today. By the end of 1918, I was baffled by this or blown away by it. By the end of 1918, five of our 15 birds of prey, goshawk, marsh harrier, honey buzzard, white-tailed eagle, and ospreys, were all driven to extinction. Yeah. And I mean, ospreys, for example, did not breed in the UK again for over 150 years.
Yeah.
That's five birds of prey that we drove to extinction. From 1940s, the peregrines were killed on government orders to protect the carrier pigeons during World War II. Because that is one of their primary food sources. So that was an interesting cause of bird of prey decline. Again, this is another one which I didn't really connect the dots on. 1955, myxomatosis was introduced to control rabbit populations, causing a massive decline in buzzards because they eat the rabbits. Yeah. I did not put those two things together. By the 1970s, golden eagle, hobby, hen harrier, red kite, and Montague's harrier all declined to fewer than 100 pairs. 1980s, we saw the ban of the organochloride pesticides.
DDTs that we mentioned.
And so we also saw the introduction of what you mentioned, the Wildlife Countryside Act in 1981, which did mean that all birds, their nests, eggs and young became legally protected, with certain species getting even stronger protections. That was a good point in the history. We then saw the reintroduction, I'm moving into some positives now, the reintroduction of white-tailed eagles successfully
in the 70s,
bred
that was.
In 1985 on moles. That was when they successfully
bred.
Yeah,
I think into Scotland they came into 19... I think they were reintroduced in about 1976 in Scotland.
1989, RSPB, Scottish Heritage and Natural England started to reintroduce red kites into England and Scotland, which
we mentioned the Roy Dennis Wildlife Foundation.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on successful reintroductions, and obviously red kites now are booming in quite a lot of places in England.
And he was instrumental, his organisation, and particularly Roy Dennis, was instrumental in reintroducing white-tailed eagles, red kites, and I think ospreys, which he then reintroduced in Wales to start off with. And
I've then got, in the 2000s, the Countryside and Rights of Countryside and Rights of Way Act in 2001 was introduced, which essentially started sentencing egg possession as a criminal offence to try and deter unlawful egg collectors. By the 2010s, some of our bird of prey populations have started to show a few signs of an increase in population. However, this is where I finished the timeline. We have seen a few, like we said, red kites have come back quite well. Persecution still continues today, and a lot more than I think people realise. We see a lot about the successful reintroductions, and say you drive down the M40 and you see a lot of red kites, but I think it's very easy to overlook the scale of illegal wildlife crimes committed against birds
of
prey.
I will tell you, I have some stats here which are quite scary.
Right, well, rattle them off.
There have been over 1,000 confirmed instances of raptor persecution in the UK since 2013. Which, when you think of the, you know, that law that came in to protect them was 1981. The fact that there are still so many incidents from 2013 onwards that we know of, and there's data going all the way through to 2022. It's some pretty shocking data, actually. Yeah. And in fact, it's not so long ago that the white-tailed eagles, which did so well with their reintroduction in Scotland, were reintroduced on the Isle of Wight 2016. They brought a pair in there. We've talked about that.
Yeah, because you've obviously seen them around here.
They then reintroduced more because it was really successful. And they have spread along the south coast here, down into Poole Harbour. They've been seen down as far as Somerset. They have bred for the first time in the south of England, first time in 240 years, at a very undisclosed location for reasons of protecting them. They're under such strict rules to not let any social media posts go out about where they fledge those white-tailed eagle chicks. But already in Hampshire, there have been two cases of white-tailed eagles having been poisoned. So that is very recently. So there's some shocking things still going on.
Yeah, and so obviously we've mentioned some of the problems that they face from pesticides and habitat loss, but really the main culprit tied to the persecution, the direct persecution of bird prey, is the game shooting industry as a whole. And just as a indicator to how recognised and prevalent this is, which I found this quite interesting, is that Dr. Mark Avery, which I said to you before we started, what a great name for somebody interested in birds. He wrote a book, which I now realise I should read, called Inglorious. And it's a book that presents a case against driven grouse shooting, which I'll define a little bit later. But in that book, he was able to state that the grouse industry is underpinned by wildlife crime. And he could make that statement without being seriously challenged by the industry, threatened with defamation lawsuits or anything like that, because it is simply a factual statement. It is not him throwing shade at an industry that he doesn't like. It is very well recognised that illegal shooting is such a big part of the game industry in this country, which is concerning when, under that, we've mentioned, Wildlife Countryside Act 1981, apart from buzzard, kestrel and sparrowhawk, all of our birds of prey also come under Schedule 1 of that, which means that that none of them can be shot, poisoned or trapped. It is an illegal crime.
Yeah, and I think having doing this research is really hard. Everything points at the gamekeepers and the big estates that are run and make money, and it is an industry, and there are lots of people employed by it. I've got to say, and I am going to say this, it's an industry I absolutely hate. I did a blog post on shooting game birds, and they call it sport. And not only do they call it sport, they actually they import millions. It's 62 million game birds are imported into the UK every single year for people to line up in a row in a field to shoot them. And honestly, it makes me emotional because I can't understand how at this day and age we are still doing that. I understand it employs people. The game shooting industry will claim that if we ban it, lots of people will be out of work. I do understand that. However, I don't understand how anyone can line across the field. And the other thing that makes horrible reading is that I think the figure was 40%. 40% of those birds aren't killed outright. 40% of those birds aren't gathered by whoever goes out to gather them, whether it be dogs or whatever. They're just left to die a horrible death because they haven't been shot outright. It's a horrible industry. Yeah, in my opinion, it's something I don't understand anymore. I maybe could have understood game bird hunting in the days when, you actually put it on the table and ate it, and we didn't have supermarkets to go to, and we didn't have access to food. I don't understand it anymore.
No, and I mean, obviously, there are alternatives. Go clay pigeon shooting, for example.
Which we did the other day. With biodegradable
pellets.
Clays, and that was great fun.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And again, no animals harmed. So, and I mean, lots of people, I think the majority of people are very anti, for example, big game hunting in Africa, for example, and will campaign against that rigorously. And yet we have a huge amount of similar problems happening here. But the obviously the point that we're making is, so we could do a whole episode, and then we got some mention of it in, I think, the adder episode, the release of game birds being, just quickly, I'll define a game bird. Weirdly, I find it quite weird that game bird shooting is the shooting of game birds, which are described as any bird that can be shot for sport. So it's a bit of a roundabout definition. People have decided that these birds are shot for sport, so they're called game birds, which typically refers to things like grouse, pheasants and partridges. And like I said, there's a big environmental impact beyond the bird of prey persecution, which we mentioned in the adder episode, where releasing things like hundreds of thousands of pheasants go and disrupt the ecosystem. Apart from the fact that they kill things like adders, they also cause competition for the local native birds. Important to note that pheasants aren't actually native to the UK.
No, nor are red-legged partridges.
No, pheasants are beautiful and I love them. They're not native. And so we could talk about the environmental impact of rearing and releasing these birds is everything from the things I've mentioned to the prevalence of like bird flu and diseases of cage rearing game birds, and environmental issues of burning moorland, all sorts of stuff. But the obviously the topic of this episode is the bird of prey persecution, which is a side effect. People are not hunting the birds of prey for the sport, because that is very much illegal. However, being birds of prey, they quite like hunting grouse and pheasants and partridges, and so they are shot to protect the stock.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation about that, though.
And I mean, they're not necessarily always shot. Poisoning and trapping is a massive thing, because it's a lot quieter, you know, to set poison. And normally what they'll do is, a lot of our bird of prey species are big carrion eaters. Yeah. That's why you see them along the motorways. And so the land managers or the gamekeepers will leave a dead animal that has been laced with a type of poison, and then birds of prey come and eat it. Obviously, the other problem with that is it's not exactly targeted, so lots of other animals will also
There's a lot of misinformation about what birds of prey actually take.
Commonly,
grouse chicks and what have you. Red kite won't. Red kite scavengers on carrion, and obviously hen harriers. They have a problem with hen harriers.
Well, hen harriers got their name because they used to hunt free range fowl.
But actually, 70% of a hen harrier's diet is actually meadow pipits. It's not grouse chicks.
Especially like nowadays, we don't really have native free range fowl.
No.
But I've
told you that 62 million game birds are released into the UK countryside each year. I'll give you some facts about how many of those are shot. 146,000 pheasants are shot every day in the UK during their respective shooting season. 38,000 red-legged partridges are shot every day in the UK during their shooting season. 5,300 red grouse are shot every day in the UK during their shooting season. It's just
the numbers are
figures.
Incredible. I think I found a statement. Yeah, so in terms of numbers of animals persecuted and killed, no other cruel sport in the UK, and the cruel sports also include things like fox hunting, for example, has such devastating impacts as the commercial game shooting. For that reason, the number of pheasants, red grouse, partridges that are shot, but also the number of birds of prey that are killed to try and, supposedly protect. I mean, of all of our birds of prey species, we've mentioned them, hen harrier are the most intensely persecuted. Interesting, because I've mentioned, and we'll talk about it more in the positive section of this episode, but the government's own research has shown that 72% of the young satellite tagged hen harriers, so those are essentially birds that have been fitted with little tags so they can track their movements, will disappear in what they call suspicious circumstances. Which is the blog that I read that from, with the source for the stat for this government study, put essentially legalised code for killed, happens on grouse moors in northern England. So their satellite tag, that's where they are tagged for before they supposedly
And it's
vanish.
Also, as I alluded to earlier on, it's a very difficult thing to monitor and to get accurate data from, because primarily it's all private land. So yeah, it's a very hard thing to accurately say it's decreasing, increasing, but what we do know is it's continuing.
Yeah, and I wasn't necessarily, because the problem with this topic, especially when it came to researching, is there's so many rabbit holes to go down. We're obviously here to really focus on the birds of prey, but it's very easy to then end up talking about, you know, the pheasants and the grouse and the fact that they're shot for sport and the environmental impacts that go with it. But one of the things I thought I would just mention, mainly because it becomes relevant later when I talk about the things that people at the campaigns people are running, is just defining the two types of grouse shooting.
Yeah.
So you've got driven, which essentially is where the grouse are, funnily enough, driven across a line of concealed guns by people, or they're called beaters, walking towards the guns. They essentially walk towards the shooters, beating the bush and causing the grouse to fly up. And then you've got walked up grouse shooting, which is where the guns actually walk across a moor in line with dogs, and the dogs flush the birds out. So those are the two types of grouse shooting. Obviously, how it relates to birds of prey is that, especially where driven shooting is carried out, the habitats and the supposed predators of the grouse are intensely managed. What that means is, apart from that, the moorland is often burned. The birds of prey are trapped, yeah, shot, and poisoned.
Yeah. The poisoning is a big thing. 43% of all confirmed bird of prey persecution incidents recorded between 2000 and 2022 were poison-related. 900 birds of prey, including white-tailed eagles, golden eagles, red kites, buzzards, sparrowhawks and peregrine falcons, dying after ingesting poison.
I've got, because I feel like we've rattled off quite a lot of generalised stats about, you know, what happens, yeah, the type of things that, yeah, that happen, but I have just got some, and it's not cheery at all, but I have got some specific examples of wildlife crimes to birds of prey in the UK. So two of the worst counties, there was a big report called the Bird Crime Report in 2021. The two worst counties based on that data were Norfolk, which had 13 incidents, and Dorset, which had 12. They're because being lowland areas, they're sort of dominated by pheasant and partridge shooting rather than the grouse shooting. The third worst county was North Yorkshire, where 10 incidents were recorded, and that's grouse, pheasant and partridge estates. One of the shocking instances involved a gruesome mass grave of birds of prey located by the RSPB and the police down a well on a pheasant shoot in Wiltshire. So it was lots of birds of prey.
I saw that on the RSPB site.
Killed, poisoned and then dumped, yeah, in a well, because obviously the crucial thing here is it is illegal.
Yeah.
So the gamekeepers who are killing the birds have to find ways of dumping the evidence. In Scotland, a golden eagle was found to have been poisoned and was lying beside a dead hare laced with deadly banned pesticide on a grouse shooting estate, and that was an estate with a history of raptor persecution. In Wales, RSPB officers assisted North Wales Police in investigating a poisoned red kite and a shot buzzard, and uncovered the worst case of illegal pesticide storage the team had ever seen. They found 18 toxic products, many of which have been banned, on a pheasant shooting estate. So again, these are all chemicals that are not allowed to be, yeah, used anymore, but are kept for the purpose of trying to kill birds of prey. So essentially, the evidence shows that the illegal persecution of birds of prey, which time and time again, almost every case is linked to some game bird shooting estate. And this evidence has actually been stated by scientists to be a key factor holding back the recovery of many of our key species.
Yeah, and also additional to that, there is definitely a perception amongst farmers that birds of prey will take their livestock. So farmers also have some historical background of persecuting birds of prey on their land, not in any way the same level as obviously the game shooting industry, the game bird industry, but things are changing, and I think farmers are beginning to realize, and we'll go on to that in the positives, because there are positives, and there is a movement and there is a general change in the perception of birds of prey taking livestock, because actually it's a myth. Even the white-tailed eagle, which is obviously a massive bird, and everybody thinks, oh, they'll just carry sheep away. They don't tend to do that. They will feed on, it tends to be carrion, so it tends to be lambs or sheep that are already died on the land for whatever reason. The same with red kites. Buzzards are not big enough to take lambs. Peregrines primarily will take pigeons and smaller birds out of the air. So this is this wrong perception that, oh, it's a bird of prey, it's going to take all our livestock. And actually it's very untrue that the diet of all of those birds tends to be carrion. I'm not saying they won't take dead lambs or whatever, they will, but they don't actively go after them.
No, it's not a big part of their diet.
No, it's definitely not a big part of their diet.
Certainly not enough to justify.
And I think there is a change. There is a change of perception, and there's some really good... There's a few really good examples.
Shall we move on to
Let's move on to some positive, because it's been pretty brutal, hasn't it?
Yeah, so just as because we've gone through all sorts of stats and figures, essentially what we're saying is that they don't consume a lot of livestock. The game bird industry typically hunts them to try and protect their game bird that they want to go and shoot. And it is certainly one of the biggest threats that our bird of prey population are facing. And I've said it before, I'm going to just emphasise the fact that it is an illegal crime. It is not just isn't it sad that people shoot birds of prey? It is a criminal offence.
Yeah.
But on that not very cheery summary, let's move on to some of the positives, some of the people working to fight this as
Can I, and as I just mentioned, the farmers.
Yeah, you
can
kick
I
it
just,
off.
There's a little thing here that there's a huge portion of the farming community that, you know, when they reintroduced the white-tailed eagles from Norway in Scotland, the farmers were actually at the airport protesting because for the reasons that I've just said, because there was this thing, it's going to be a threat to our livestock. But they've gone from that now to working really closely with raptor conservation groups. And many farmers now are realising that these birds of prey aren't a threat that they once imagined they were. And there's some really good examples of this. And it comes from the fact that when raptors, I'll read this little bit because actually it's really cool. When raptors start to reclaim what was once their territory, we see a change. The number of rodents go way down. There's an example in Donegal in Northern Ireland where golden eagles were released. There was actually more successful lambing in the seasons because all of the foxes at once would have carried away the lambs. It's not the birds of prey doing that. The foxes obviously have been allowed to thrive and the fox population had increased, and now they are getting carried off by golden eagles. So the predation of the lambs by foxes has been reduced. So actually they had more success with birds of prey on their farmland than they did when they weren't there. So I thought that was a really good example. And the farmers are recognising that. The farmers are recognising, again, there's a balance.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about changes in agricultural and land use has seen a huge increase in predators such as crows and foxes. So nature is out of balance. The ground nesting birds that they always predated on, but there's an imbalance now because there's more of those predators. So that's thrown nature right out. If you let nature do its thing, it tends to balance out, doesn't it?
We've also seen that sort of hopeful change in farmer views and in other areas, like with, for example, beavers. There's always the weird thought that they might eat fish. They just eat vegetables, they eat plants, they're not fish eaters at all. There are other reasons why farmers may have problems with beavers, but then in the areas where the beavers have been reintroduced, a lot of farmers have gone, oh, actually look, our land's not flooding like it used to, the river is more,
the water's
healthy,
cleaner.
And there's actually, look at all the benefits. Yeah. And so those changing perceptions are vital, because it means that where the reintroductions have been somewhat isolated and at some point a little bit sneaky, we can start trying to mainstream them, if I want to use a technical jargony term.
Yeah.
And it's the same for the birds of prey. We need the groups that would perhaps have an issue with them based on information that may not be necessarily correct, realise that actually there are... the wildlife in this land evolved with them. They are part of the ecosystem, and having them is really important for bringing that balance back.
We've said that a lot, haven't we? In lots of episodes about that balance, and it works with birds of prey, funnily enough. So that was just one example of now the farming community is starting to realise, they can
work
live
together.
And work together with birds of prey on their land. I don't know what you've got
I've got things. So we've mentioned that one of the problems with these crimes of killing birds of prey is it's very easy for them to go unseen. It's happening on private land. It can be done very quietly with poison. However,
and there's no accountability at all, is there?
However, more and more we're seeing projects that satellite tag these birds, allowing them to be tracked, which sadly, even if it means that it's too late to save the bird, it will at least show where they've ended up. You've actually got the RSPB who have created a raptor persecution map that shows all the confirmed incidents across the UK. Okay. It's a bit like, it's just a data map, so you can go and see where the problem areas are. So it actually just, we've said it in so many episodes, gathering the data and understanding the problem is a big part to try and solve it. Sticking with RSPB, they also ran a really cool project called the Hen Harrier Life Project.
Yeah.
It was 5 years from 2014 to 2019. And essentially, it assessed the threats to the hen harriers and then worked to protect them. And just, it was actually a very successful project. 5 years, it protected over 100 nests and 150 winter roosts, tagged over 100 birds, catalogued 328 bird crimes. They worked with land managers to show how moorlands could be managed more sustainably. They talked about the problems facing hen harriers with nearly 13,000 people. And they actually, I just thought I'd give the same shout out that the RSPB did. They gave a bit of a shout out to Northern England Raptor Forum and the Scottish Raptor Study Group, whose members donated thousands of hours trying to protect and monitor these birds. And again, it's just a really nice example of people working so hard for the birds of prey.
Yeah, and so we've obviously given gamekeepers a bit of a bad rap today, but there are stories such as gamekeepers on an estate in Langholm in Scotland are now using diversionary feeding tactics. And what that means is that they are essentially leaving food out for the harriers so they don't steal the grouse.
Quote unquote stealing.
Quote unquote stealing. And 86% fewer game birds were raptured, as they say, or obviously taken by the hen harriers. So now gamekeepers are realising actually, you know, they can work alongside hen harriers being on there more.
I've just got to get them to stop shooting grouse.
We'd just like to get them to stop shooting at all.
Yeah. But it's still nice to see that, you know, it's not nice to see them doing the sport. As you can tell, we don't like the sport. But it's it's good to see that they are trying to find ways to minimise their impact on the other animals.
Well, I'm going to quote Tim Weston here, Director for Conservation Policy and Politics at the National Gamekeepers Organisation. And he said, the NGO has a very robust stance on any wildlife crime and a zero tolerance policy towards any incident involving the illegal killing of birds of prey. The facts are that birds of prey are thriving on land managed for shooting. And the figures show us that all UK raptors are on the increase. And the hen harrier is in fact doing best on moors managed for grouse shooting. Over 100 hen harriers fledged on grouse moors last breeding season alone, far more than any so-called nature reserve. And gamekeepers are leading on important conservation projects in England, including southern hen harrier reintroduction. So they would claim, and they would argue, they're doing more than anybody else to protect and conserve the hen harrier.
So at times I want to be diplomatic. And I also
Tim Weston said it, and I'm quoting his name and everything on here. Tim Weston said that.
We're just going to obviously ignore the impact of releasing loads of game birds led.
Oh, he didn't mention that bit, funny enough.
The burning of the land.
Yeah, no, he didn't mention that bit either.
No. Or the cultivation of massive amounts of bird flu.
No, he didn't mention that.
It's all fine. I'm not bitter.
Anyway, what you got?
I'll move on. It's supposed to be positive. In our bid to highlight cool organisation, one that I'm actually a big fan of, I think I might have even applied for a job with them. I can't remember when I was hunting for jobs, is the League Against Cruel Sports. And what's interesting is a bit like what you've just mentioned. You've got charities that work with the game industry, and they work to make the practices more sustainable, limiting, trying to reduce bird crime, trying to limit the impact of all the other things that we've mentioned that the game industry sort of has, you know, releasing lots of birds, etc. The League Against Cruel Sports are very much just campaigning for a complete ban of the shooting industry entirely. And I will say, I like that stance, but they I've realised, obviously, that that's quite a difficult target. So they campaign for change in a variety of ways. They provide animal crime watch services. They educate a lot of people on the issues. They protect reserves, and they actually at the moment are campaigning for the ban of cage breeding of game birds in Wales, which is another like important step, especially for things like the diseases we mentioned. And it's very similar to the Protect the Wild charity, who they do all sorts.
They're really good. That's a really good website as well.
Yeah, it is. They have a lot of information, and they work essentially towards protecting British wildlife, but they campaign mainly against things like fox hunting, shooting, also things like the badger cull, and all those sorts of stuff. And they work really hard to try and change government policy. And one of the things they do brilliantly, and they're not easy watches, but I think are very important watches, is they create incredible animations.
All right.
So I remember seeing the one about fox hunting during the season where that happens. And it's a tough watch because it's quite emotional, but they create an incredible educational animation of a fox being hunted by men on horses with dogs.
I think that's pretty hard.
And it goes all over social media. Yeah. It's a good way to introduce people to just the cruelty behind some of these sports. But they, again, I actually might have got those two things modelled up in the sense that they are the ones who are fighting to eradicate the shooting industry completely. Yeah. League Against Cruel Sports at the moment are working on the ban against cage breeding. So Protect the Wild are the ones who, I think even on their website, which like we said is a fantastic website, says that one day we will have a world without it, and they are working very hard towards that. Again, we'll stick links to all these charities because a lot of the information we gather comes from these places, and some of the effort that they've gone to try and spread awareness around the actual like nuanced issues of these industries is fantastic. I have two other points to make.
Okay.
I'm conscious of how long we've been talking about this topic, but I don't know if you've got anything else positive you wanted to...
Well, I would always talk positively about, obviously, the reintroductions have been very successful, the red kites in particular. And what I found really interesting, there was, I think it was called Flying Kites, the UK's most successful bird conservation project, which was instrumental in reintroducing red kites. And that red kite introduction, which we talked about, as I say, in previous episodes, has been hugely successful. But what I really liked about that was when the reintroductions were happening, we were sourcing red kite chicks from Spain. And now the red kite population in Spain is really struggling. So we're now returning the favour, and so successful is a red kite reintroduction been here, we are now providing red kite chicks for their reintroduction in Spain. And I think that is
good.
That's fantastic, considering they've been driven to extinction. They were called vermin, and there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that they were threatening livestock or anything. But it was a bird of prey, so let's just shoot it. It's vermin. And now that's been a fantastic... a fantastic success story. My positives are the fact that those reintroductions are creating public awareness. Look at the publicity and the awareness around the white-tailed eagle, which has been fantastic. White-tailed eagle success in Scotland, it brings in tourism. We know we were a tourist.
Yeah, I actually forgot to mention that. People always talk about the economic value of the game industry. However, the economic value of the tourism that big birds of prey.
Well,
bring.
Look at the red kite feeding stations or on farmland. Farmers have allocated parts of their land to red kite feeding stations. There's a place, I think it's in Gloucestershire somewhere.
Yeah, go listen to our successful reintroductions episode.
And you can go and watch 150 red kites coming down from a bird hide. It's an incredible experience. And that's that's bringing in tourism.
You also get people that flock to cities to see peregrines at the top of cathedrals.
Well, actually, that's an interesting thing, the way peregrines, because of the persecution, have adapted and they've gone in and realised that the urban environment is much safer.
Yeah, one of the places I've always routinely seen them is the cathedral in Chichester.
Well, you went as a young lad to photograph
them. Took all your camera gear on the train.
And, of course, they're using artificial light at night. They're using buildings that are replicating cliff faces, and we've seen them. In fact, there's a thing there that was saying that peregrines in cities have actually become famous. Some of them have got their own Instagram pages.
Yeah, and it brings people in.
So that's the kind of publicity we want around birds of prey, because and so that's the positives for me. Is that all of this public awareness around those reintroductions has created that people understanding birds of prey more, and not the fact that they're going to
cause problems.
Cause problems.
I mean, we haven't really emphasised the fact that they're just also magnificent animals to watch. They are stunning.
Things.
I mean, you've got two on your arm.
Two tattooed on my arm.
Kestrel and a white-tailed eagle. The last organisation I wanted to mention was called Wild Justice.
Yeah.
And interestingly, this is a not-for-profit company and not a charity, because charities sort of have to stay somewhat non-political, and this organisation wanted to make sure there were no limits on what activities they could sort of campaign against, and even campaign against governmental policies and things like that. So they've stayed as not a charity. And it was actually set up by Dr. Mark Avery, the person who I mentioned earlier, who wrote the book. He also runs a fantastic blog and Twitter account called Raptor Persecution, which I would... It's not a nice necessary account to follow, but it's an important account. Dr. Ruth Tingay, I'm really sorry if Ruth, you're listening and I've got your name wrong.
He's terrible at names.
Who's a conservationist and was actually a previous president of the Raptor Research Foundation, and Chris Packham, who doesn't necessarily need an introduction because we probably all know
and
Chris
Packham. And he's passionate about birds of prey.
Yeah, so this is an organisation set up by those three, and they actually take legal challenges against the UK government and their agencies to campaign for a better deal for wildlife, not just birds of prey, but for wildlife in general. But they've been proposing schemes in legal cases, including things like adding pheasants and red-legged partridges to Schedule 9 of the Wildlife Countryside Act, which essentially contains a list of species that cause ecological, environmental, or socio-economic harm. So that actually also includes things like grey squirrels and Japanese knotweed, so invasive species. But crucially for the game industry, what that means is that those species cannot be released unless under license. So
yes, I saw that.
The industry, each game or estate would have to be licensed to release the birds. It can't just be...
I wonder how it's regulated, though.
That would be... It would be important if it needed to be licensed. Also, things they've proposed in the schemes are things like refusing to license game bird releases on or within 1 kilometre of certain nature sites, as well as a ban on the use of lead ammunition near nature sites, further research, assessments, all sorts of things. And they are doing this in legal cases. And it's quite, not, I'd say, revolutionary in the sense that it's not something that's often taken in a legal stance. So they are working very hard out there. These are just the ones relevant to birds of prey. They're doing loads of other good stuff. And what have you mentioned with the regulation? That's one of the things that I've got right down at the bottom of my notes, is that a bit like a lot of other environmental issues that we've spoken about, I mean, obviously I could talk about things like the sewage problems and stuff like that, that self-regulation of these industries doesn't work because they are profit-making industries. So you cannot trust necessarily the game estates to regulate themselves out of the goodness of their own heart. What we need is, these are crimes, they need to have proper punishments and regulations.
Yes, so actually, when I look at the punishment for...
They are very minor.
Very light.
So what we really need is that there's all this incredible work being done, but one of the things that would be a huge win is for proper sentencing, not just for birds of prey, but for wildlife crimes in general.
Yeah.
So that that just, more than anything, acts as a bigger deterrent if you're facing proper jail time rather than a slight slap on the wrist. That needs to be enforced, and a lot of these organizations are campaigning very
well.
This hard.
One, did you mention Raptor Persecution UK? Because that's another good site.
No.
And they've done a huge amount of increasing public and media and political awareness of the scale of raptor persecution. Yeah. So that's another good website. So we'll put the link down for
that
too.
It's just another case where it doesn't matter what topic we pick, what issue that we find to talk about, there's always a phenomenal collection of organisations and people who are working so hard.
Always.
All of these organisations have volunteers who during certain hunt seasons are out there helping, who are protecting nests,
counting birds,
tagging, all sorts of stuff. And these organisations are out there. People may not know about them. Some of these are new to me that I didn't know until I did this research, who are working day in and day out to try and protect our birds of prey.
Yeah, this is
it's heartwarming.
This is a difficult one as well, because sometimes in our episodes we can give, you know, people who maybe weren't aware of various things, how they can help and how they can keep an eye on things or behave differently in countryside to protect things, whatever. This one's a really tricky one because mostly it's on private land. You can't even, you know, you wouldn't even probably come across a bird that has been poisoned.
However, if you do, and I will stick a link in, one of the most important things is to report
absolutely.
It. So that it can
you'd
be...
report it, what, to DEFRA or...?
Well, yes, but also you can do it through these charities who will then take it, and it might carry more weight than individuals.
So it's a really tricky one as far as what you can do to help. And I don't think it is an episode for that. It's just an episode of creating awareness that these things are going on.
Yeah, making sure that people... do know that this is a problem, and maybe, you know, it's one of those things where when the petitions go around, there have been petitions to try and reduce, whether it's the a way that or driven grouse shooting land is managed, or the cage breeding of game birds in Wales, that had a big petition, for example. And when these petitions do come around, people are more aware of the issues, why it's an important topic. Yeah. It's not just, oh, a group of people don't like the sport. Yeah. It actually has huge consequences for wildlife beyond the birds that are shot. That when these petitions and campaigns come around, people will recognise them and go, I know why that's important.
Yes.
Let's add my name to that list, and just keeping an eye out for those opportunities
also,
to help.
You know, inevitably as well, there are various sites. I think Raptor Persecution UK is one where you can go on and donate, because there's a huge amount of work that's being done. Resources are tight, funding is tight.
As always for charities.
As ever with charities. So there are little ways you can do that, and every £5 makes a difference.
And if nothing else, take an opportunity to go to a nature reserve and see if you can spot a bird of prey, because I've... challenge anybody who can't find the sight of a kestrel hovering with its head so perfectly still, anything other than magnificent.
I mean, now, you know, if you could see white-tailed eagles in the south of England down at Poole Harbour.
Go and see. Even
and if you've never seen a white-tailed eagle,
they are huge,
fly overhead, it is a sight to behold.
Even just taking a moment to admire those that you see more commonly, like a buzzard or a red kite. Well, I say commonly for us down in the south, things like that. It's just appreciate the birds of prey that we
Absolutely.
Have.
They are magnificent animals.
But beyond that, I hope the episode wasn't too gloomy. I think we've managed to weave in some interesting facts and
well,
things
sometimes
like that.
Gloomy, but gloomy can sometimes
gloomy,
be really
important.
It's a really important subject.
Yeah, and, one's
definitely close to our hearts.
Yeah, I've always been a big fan of Birds of Prey. But beyond that, I hope it's been interesting. I definitely want to go and read Dr. Mark Avery's book, Inglorious.
Yes, me too.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
And we'll catch you next time.
We'll catch you next time. Thanks very much. Bye. Bye-bye.